Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We are here to help you improve your American English skills and learn about important world events at the same time. Today we have two stories about technology. How can satellites help predict disease outbreaks down on Earth? Details are just moments away. Then, the use of technology in the fight against terrorism. Two stories you need to hear, coming up on As It Is. Meningitis is spreading across West Africa. The brain disease is a threat every year across 21 African countries. Health officials call this area the meningitis belt. Now, scientists have found they can predict and prepare for this and other diseases. How? They use information from satellites orbiting the Earth. Every year, dust storms blow across the Sahel area of Africa, and every year, meningitis crosses the Sahel after the storms. Carlos Perez Garcia Pando is an atmospheric scientist with the American Space Agency, NASA. He spoke to VOA on Skype.
Meningitis has been one of the most feared dry season diseases in Africa for a long time.
The Sahel stretches from the West African nation of Senegal to Ethiopia in the east. Tens of thousands of people across this area get the disease each year. About 10% of those infected die from the disease. Another 10 to 20% suffer permanent brain or nerve damage. Mr. Garcia Pando says scientists have yet to understand why meningitis appears to follow the seasonal dust storms in the Sahel. But he says experts do have the technology to study the storms. Satellites can watch these storms develop and examine the conditions that create them. The NASA scientist says dust storms are his specialty. Yet he admits he had not studied meningitis until the World Health Organization contacted him. There are not enough vaccines available to protect everyone in the Sahel from meningitis. But Mr. Perez Garcia Pando says it would help to know when and where the disease will strike. So he and other researchers developed a system that studies satellite measurements of dust, wind, and humidity levels across the Sahel. The researchers also need to know the number of cases already identified by the end of the year. Using this information, they found they could predict how bad the next meningitis season would be. This is just one of several ways experts are looking to the skies for help in predicting the spread of disease. Nita Barty is with Penn State University. She says she can predict the spread of measles by watching city lights grow brighter.
The changes in brightness are telling us something about increasing and decreasing human aggregation, and that's very likely driving the transmission of measles.
Ms. Barty spoke to VOA on Skype. She says the disease measles loves a crowd. In Niger's capital, Niamey, the population grows in the dry season as farmers arrive from the countryside. They are looking for work in the city. Brightness from their electric lights and cooking fires can be seen in satellite imagery of the area. Ms. Barty and her team found they could predict how measles would spread through Niamey by watching parts of the city light up.
The satellite can become a really powerful public health tool.
That was Rita Colwell of the University of Maryland. Her group found it could predict cases of the deadly disease cholera in Bangladesh by using satellite information about conditions in the Bay of Bengal. Cholera bacteria live on sea creatures that eat very small organisms known as plankton. She and NASA researchers thought they could predict an increase in cholera cases by studying plankton levels in the water.
I'll never forget, we were doing the calculations and bingo, it just fell right into place. It was very exciting.
Her group and other researchers hope to use satellites in disease prediction as other scientists use them to predict the weather. I'm Jim Tedder.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Before the end of the month, U.S. lawmakers must decide what to do about a federal government program for gathering intelligence. The National Security Agency currently is able to collect records about telephone calls made in the United States. The NSA has permission to use the information in the government's fight against terrorism. The information gathering has angered many civil liberties activists and some members of Congress. As Christopher Jones Cruz reports, lawmakers can support extension of the program, propose changes, or even cancel it.
Last week, a federal appeals court said the collection of so much information was illegal. But the court did not order the NSA to stop it. Even before that ruling, some members of Congress were calling for changes in the way the NSA operates. Patrick Leahy is on the Senate Judiciary Committee and a member of the Democratic Party.
I believe we have to protect our national security, but we also have to protect our civil liberties, which make us unique as a country.
The program was first revealed by Edward Snowden, who once had a job with a company that worked for the NSA. He showed that the agency was gathering records about phone calls made within the United States. His claims angered many Americans. Last year, President Barack Obama sought to lessen the country's fears about the program.
The United States is not spying on ordinary people who don't threaten our national security. And we take their privacy concerns into account in our policies and procedures.
The NSA reportedly collects and stores phone records, but it does not keep records of what was said. After the appeals court ruled that the program was illegal, several Republicans spoke in support of the NSA's activities. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was one of the speakers.
The NSA can find connections from known terrorists overseas and connect that to potential terrorists here in the United States. Critics of the program either want to do away with it or make it much more difficult to use.
Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Burr also opposes calls to end the program.
We're going to keep America safe. We're not going to let it revert back to where we're susceptible to another 9/11.
But other lawmakers believe the program is a threat to privacy, including Senator Rand Paul, who is seeking the Republican nomination for president.
I say the phone records of law-abiding citizens are none of their damn business.
President Obama says the fact that political leaders are talking about the program shows the difference between the U.S. and other nations.
No one expects China to have an open debate about their surveillance programs, or Russia to take privacy concerns of citizens in other places into account. But let's remember, we are held to a different standard precisely because we have been at the forefront of defending personal privacy and human dignity.
Many experts believe the Supreme Court will one day decide whether the program is legal under the U.S. Constitution. The Supreme Court is often asked to make a final ruling on decisions made by appeals courts. Until such a ruling comes, Congress can extend the program order changes to it or cancel it. Lawmakers from both parties say it is important for national security and civil liberties that they make the right decision. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Do you consider yourself a morning person or an evening person? If you like to wake up early, you are what we call a lark. If you prefer staying up late, you are a night owl. These are two slang expressions you will need to know to understand the following report. It will also be helpful to know these two commonly used words, midnight and habit. Midnight is simply the middle of the night, or 12 a.m. Habit is something that a person does often in a regular and repeated way. The two biological terms you will need to know are metabolism and chronotype. Metabolism is the chemical process by which a plant or animal uses food and water to grow, heal, and make energy. A chronotype simply refers to when an organism prefers to sleep and wake. A new study in South Korea found that night owls are at increased risk of developing diabetes, more so than larks. Researchers found this to be the case even when the two groups slept the same number of hours. The study found that people who go to bed well after midnight develop more health problems than people who go to bed early. Orfeo Buxton studies the human brain and nervous system in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Mr. Buxton was not involved in the Korea study, but he says that the relationship between sleep and disease has to do with the human body clock. He says the clock prepares the body for activities linked to time of day. He says eating in the morning is something human bodies seem ready for. He says humans shut down as night comes. So eating at night is more likely to have unwanted results, like weight gain around the middle of the body. The Korean researchers compared the health habits and metabolism of just more than 1,600 participants, ages 47 to 59. They divided the group by their so-called chronotype, or sleep-wake cycle. Just more than 33% of them were identified as morning chronotypes. Evening chronotypes made up just less than 6%. The other 60% of the 1,600 people were somewhere in the middle between early risers and those who stayed up late. The researchers found that night owls, or evening chronotypes, had higher levels of body fat and fats in their blood. They also had more muscle wasting than the larks. This was true even among younger evening chronotypes. Mr. Buxton says people whose jobs start later in the day were more likely to have the signs that put them at increased risk for diabetes. He says the night owls generally had unhealthier lifestyles, including less exercise. He says more of them also smoked tobacco and ate later in the day. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Germany's attack on Poland and the start of World War II in Europe presented a problem for Americans in September of 1939. The United States, by law, was neutral, and few Americans had any desire to fight in another world war. But most Americans did not like Germany's Nazi leader, Adolf Hitler. They hoped for victory for Britain, France, and the other Allied powers. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt made this clear in a radio broadcast to Americans soon after the war began.
The overwhelming masses of our people seek peace. Peace at home, and the kind of peace in other lands which will not jeopardize our peace at home. We have certain ideas and certain ideals of national safety, and we must act to preserve that safety today and to preserve the safety of our children in future years. That safety is and will be bound up with the safety of the Western Hemisphere and of the seas adjacent thereto. We seek to keep war from our own firesides by keeping war from coming to the Americas.
He praised the British and other allies. Finally, the president called on Congress to change the neutrality laws that prevented him from sending arms to the Allies to help them fight Germany. Congress agreed to change the laws so foreign nations could buy American arms. In the months that followed, Hitler and his allies claimed one victory after another. German and Soviet troops captured Poland quickly in September of 1939. Then Soviet forces invaded the small Baltic nations of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. In late November, they attacked Finland. Fighting between Finland and the Soviet Union continued through the winter until Finland accepted Russia's demands. Fighting grew even more fierce the following spring in 1940. Germany attacked Denmark and Norway, defeating them easily. In May, German forces struck like lightning through Belgium and Holland. Within one day, they were in France. British and French forces were unable to stop the Germans from moving deep into northern France. The British finally had to flee from the European continent. They sailed back to Britain from the French town of Dunkirk. German soldiers marched through France, and Italian forces joined them by invading France from the south. Soon, Paris fell. These are German newsreel narrators describing German troops entering Paris and the fall of the French government. A German supporter, Marshal Pétain, took control of the French government, and France, beaten and crushed, was forced to sign a peace treaty with Hitler. Now it was just Britain alone against Hitler and his Axis allies. Only the English Channel separated the British people from a German army that seemed unbeatable. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was forced to resign. The British people turned to a new leader, Winston Churchill.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. A tremendous battle is raging in France, a and Flanders. The Germans, by a remarkable combination of air bombing and heavily armored tanks, have broken through the French defenses north of the Maginot Line, and strong columns of their armored vehicles are ravaging the open country, which for the first day or two was without defenders. They have penetrated deeply and spread alarm and confusion in their track.
Churchill would prove to be strong and brave in the long months ahead. The British would need strong leadership. Hitler wasted no time in launching a fierce air attack on Britain. Throughout the summer, German and British planes fought above the English Channel. All of this military action had an important effect on American popular opinion. War and neutrality were no longer just ideas to be discussed and debated. Now they were real concerns, real events. Fascist troops, led by a dictator in Berlin, were defeating one friendly democracy after another, and Soviet forces were on the march, too. Most Americans still wanted neutrality. But how long could America remain at peace? And was peace worth the cost of just sitting by and watching friends like France and Britain being bombed and invaded? Other issues melted away as Americans began to consider what to do about the darkening world situation. Some Americans, led by newspaper publisher William Allen White, called for the United States to help Britain immediately. But other groups, like the America First Committee, demanded that the United States stay out of another bloody European conflict. The struggle between those who wanted to help Britain and those who wanted to remain neutral did not follow traditional party lines. Some of the strongest supporters of Roosevelt's foreign policies were Republicans. Some members of his own Democratic Party opposed his policies. Even so, foreign policy was one of the main issues in the presidential election campaign of 1940. The Democrats once again nominated Franklin Roosevelt for president. The Republicans had several popular candidates who were interested in campaigning against Roosevelt. At first, it seemed that these candidates would fight it out in a bitter nominating convention in Philadelphia. But to everyone's surprise, a little-known candidate named Wendell Willkie suddenly gained a great deal of support and won the nomination.
For the building of an adequate defense, so that no dictator, however strong, may seek to strike, for the unity of our people, for calling again America to its great tradition of progress, I pledge myself to you, and I ask each of you to join with me in this great crusade.
Willkie was a tough candidate. He was friendly, a good businessman, and a strong speaker. He seemed honest, and he seemed to understand foreign policy. Most importantly, Willkie had a progressive record on many social issues. He was not the kind of traditional conservative Republican that Roosevelt had defeated so easily in his first two campaigns. Instead, Willkie could claim to represent the average American just as well as Roosevelt, and he offered the excitement of a change in leadership. While Roosevelt and Willkie began their campaign battles with words, German and British planes were fighting real battles with bullets over the English Channel. Winston Churchill sent a desperate message to Roosevelt. The British Prime Minister said Britain could not fight alone much longer. It needed help immediately. Roosevelt did not want to take steps toward war just before an election. but neither could he refuse such an urgent appeal from the British leader. Roosevelt and Wilkie discussed the situation. Wilkie agreed not to criticize Roosevelt when the president sent 50 ships to the British Navy. He also supported Roosevelt's order for American young men to give their names to Army officials so they could be called up if fighting began. In this way, Roosevelt and Wilkie tried to keep America's growing involvement in the war from becoming a major political issue in the election. President Roosevelt won the election of 1940. He won 27 million votes to 22 million for Wilkie. This made Roosevelt the first and only president in American history to win a third term in the White House. The Constitution was later changed to limit presidents to two terms. Soon after the election, President Roosevelt received a letter from Winston Churchill. The British Prime Minister wrote that Britain urgently needed more arms and planes to fight Germany. Roosevelt agreed. He went to the Congress to plead for more aid to Britain. He said the United States should change its neutral policy because Britain was fighting a common enemy of democracy. Roosevelt also said the United States could avoid war if Britain was strong enough to defeat Germany by itself. Congress agreed, after a fierce debate, to increase aid to Britain. And in the weeks and months that followed, the United States moved closer and closer to open war with Germany. In March of 1941, Roosevelt allowed British ships to come to American ports to be repaired. In June, the United States seized ships under German control. It also took over German and Italian funds in American banks. Open fighting could not be prevented with this increase in tension between Germany and the United States. In September 1941, a German submarine fired at an American ship. The ship was not damaged, but a number of American troops were killed in other naval incidents that followed. By the end of 1941, the United States and Germany were almost at war. Even so, most Americans continued to hope for peace. In fact, few Americans could guess that war was just days away. The first blow would come not from Germany, however, but from Japan.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
That will be our story next week. Our program was written by David Jarmel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.